KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail?
Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
Shake it, don't break it.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm sitting across from a man who basically has chosen a lot of great directors to work with. We can go from Terrence Malick to Woody Allen to Oliver Stone to Steven Spielberg, where he wore a suit so tight I thought he couldn't move in Minority Report. He's also worked with a number of repeat directors. He's worked several times with Martin McDonagh and Neil Jordan and Joel Schumacher, who brought him to America. He worked on Tim Roth's first film. Gosh, almost 20 years ago now that was. And he's sitting here. We're talking about, of course, the film The Lobster. I'm talking with Colin Farrell. Thanks so much for being here, Colin.
Thanks for having me, Elvis.
It was completely my pleasure. And something we were talking about before we got started, and I want to really broach with you because it really comes to rest for me in The Lobster, is you choose a lot of roles that feel kind of spiritual to me.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. That's certainly not a target that I've aimed my arrow at. I think, you know, the notion of spirituality is something that you can imbue any topic or any situation with, if that's your proclivity. I do feel myself that the human experience is one of spirituality, whether you reach for faith or you don't. I think the idea of spirit and spiritedness speaks to the strengths, the braveries, the doubts, the suspicions, the fears that we all share as human beings, whether you're a father or a lover or a creator or whatever it may be, a son, a daughter, a friend. The idea of connection with your fellow human beings, to me, is kind of a spiritual practice and experience. So maybe with that in line, you know, maybe some of the roles that I've done have been imbued with that. But, you know, there has been, I suppose, a certain amount of existential crises that the characters I have, whether it's the character in Ondine as somebody who begins to, when he has given up hope for the arrival of any love in his life, needs this fantastical story to be introduced to his life to believe in the virtues and the presence of love and the potential for redemption again. That's kind of a spiritual journey. You know, Joseph Campbell would speak about that. And, you know, In Bruges, a film that's about as irreverent, as violent as any film I'll probably do, has a deep spiritual vein through it, but I wouldn't call Martin McDonagh a spiritualist at all. He's a very pragmatic, very logically minded man. Now, I'm not saying he doesn't have faith, but just in how he exists and how he, you know, converses and how he shares his tales. But that's an all right thing, man. That's a nice thing.
I just think interesting because, again, we were talking about The Lobster before we sat down, and that's very much a film, to me, that feels like it's set in purgatory.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the characters you played, I was thinking about in The New World, for example, the guys who are kind of going through that sort of stage between heaven and hell, kind of figuratively, and trying to figure out where they're going to step and where they belong.
Exactly, yeah. Well, purgatory is what? It's the meeting point of two potentially aggressive past and a future. You know, it's that Netherland in the middle. It's that thing that is drawn about and written about by, you know, the great poets and great Renaissance painters. But it's also something that we practically experience. You know, a couple going through a divorce are stuck, landlocked in a modern day contemporary purgatory. So purgatory is a time of great change. And I think a lot of the characters I've played have been going through these changes where their own ideologies, their own behaviours, their own philosophies on life are being brought into question. And within that, there's great struggle and there's great opportunity for drama.
That idea that these guys are basically have to choose between their pasts and their futures,
that's
almost something that you... It's kind of a weather vane for you in some
way. I mean, it's really, you know, you mentioned Martin McDonagh. It's really embodied in Bruges. I mean, In Bruges to me, as the hotel and The Lobster felt to you like a purgatory, In Bruges, the actual city and what it serves and how it plays a backdrop to what these characters are going through as they're waiting for the call from you know, the guy from London, is purely a purgatory. It's you know, you're not walking the streets, you're on a treadmill. Your legs are moving, but you're going nowhere. You're stuck in the amber of time, and you have too much time to deliberate and too much time to wonder on your hands, and it can drive you to a madness.
And weirdly, but, in Bruges, it only seems to take place in real time.
Yeah, Yeah, real time. But it's you know, the act that Ray committed that has them arrive at Bruges is such an act of violence and creates such a kind of a aftershock of guilt and remorse and shame and self-loathing and self-pity that he is stuck in this purgatorial place. And I mean, I understand, as you do, I'm sure, the nature of change. And, you know, we have to be allowed as human beings, whether it's as artists or just as women and men, to shed, you know, to be like that serpent and shed the skin and birth ourselves anew at a moment's notice. I mean, you know, if you're talking scientific terms, evolution takes place over whatever it may be, eons, thousands of years. But if you're talking in, again, spiritual terms or humane terms, evolution can take place in a moment. You can have a wake up in a moment and realize that you need to change something or you need to be a particular way or your philosophies are a little bit askew or askance from what will serve you best as a human being and thereby serve your community best as well.
I guess I ask you this because the idea of characters who have to decide if they want to change or not, mm-hmm. is that something that really feels like it's comfortable to you as an actor?
Well, you know, I think as an actor, stagnation is kind of death, you know. So playing characters that are going through change means that there is internal motion. And I'm not talking about, you know, frenetic movement externalized physically, but internal motion is really important. Internal discourse with the self, however conscious or unconscious the character may be about that conversation that's happening.
Well, so much that discomfort, that awkwardness takes place over these characters you played in movies that are comedic.
Right, yeah, yeah. You know, the only person, Ray in Bruges, the only person who's more uncomfortable than the discomfort he creates for the people in a space that he may inhabit is him. You know, there's some people, and I've met them, I wonder if you have, where they're so uncomfortable in themselves, but they've been that way for so long, there's kind of a comfort in it for them, but they make everyone around them really uncomfortable. Ray is kind of like that, you know, so...
But yeah, but these are guys who I think by being kind of reluctant to change or asking questions about change, that we could say the same thing about Cassandra or any number of movies yeah. we talk about that you've done, yeah. are these guys who are like that guy. Because of their unwillingness to confront this change mm-hmm. or to embrace change, they create chaos around them.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the character in Cassandra, he was, yeah, I mean, I think I've played quite a few characters that are kind of malformed.
Really? Good. Tell me more about this,
guy. Unformed, you know? I mean, I don't know if anyone ever completes the journey between from boy to man or from girl to woman. I don't know that we ever shed the things that we experienced and processed when we were children. I think the kind of internal wrestle or agitation of being an adult is how to step from the shadow of your own upbringing, whatever that is, however privileged or however difficult that is. And so I played characters like Ray or like the character in Terry in Cassandra's Dream or even the Lobster who are carrying a weight and a burden that they're not even aware of themselves.
It's a treat. We're talking about Journeys, not the band, with my guest Colin Farrell, who's done a number of films. Most recently, The Lobster, which is now available. We've seen home video on any number of platforms. But I think... Well, I guess I've always wondered for you that this kind of panic that verges on melancholy, mm-hmm. is that something you find in the script or do you try to discover it as you're on the floor?
I don't try and discover it. I probably have quite a melancholy nature. I mean,
is that true?
I do find myself at times, I think it's not exclusively an Irish attribute, but the Irish as a race, I mean, we are quite melancholy. We are somewhere between trying to step from that shadow of our past that I spoke about and completely unable to relinquish the grip that we both have on that past and it has on us, because there's a certain shame in forgetting those who came before you, for us anyway, whether we realize it or not. And I think that is at times can stick us in a certain pattern of behaviors as Irish people, and some of it is beautiful and we have a great sense of community but I think there's also a sensitivity in Irish men that they're not really permitted by each other and by themselves to explore. And if that's true, and maybe it's only me, but I don't think it's me out of just, you know, 1.2 million male adults or whatever the population is at the moment, if that is true, well then I get to express that through my work, you know, in film.
I guess I should say it's just because I was thinking about Martin, your work with Martin between Seven Psychopaths and in Bruges. Again, these are both kind of middle passages for these characters. Mm-hmm. And they're both fairly bleak surroundings in yeah. some ways. And there is, I hate to keep harping on this, but a kind of purgatorial aspect to Seven Psychopaths as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's an argument that life is purgatory. I mean, this whole thing is just, you know, a transitory station that we're stopping off on, you know, that there is so much that is being resolved or so much being provoked in this journey from the day you're born to the day you die. So there's an argument for the idea that, again, philosophically, this whole human experience is a purgatory, where none of us are really certain of what our purpose is. I mean, one of the great agitators of the human experience is, why am I here? You know, it's what the scientists and philosophers and Galileo back to, and, you know, painters and writers and filmmakers today and singers and songwriters, you know, have tried to figure out. And you try to figure out what is your purpose by expressing yourself or having relationships or viewing your experience in relation to those around you or the world at large. And then there's times where you try to experience it just within the self, where you're not contingent on the environment you find yourself in. You're not reliant on the relationships. You maybe try to access some part within yourself where you realize that just by virtue of your breath alone, you should be here. Whatever your origins, whether your parents loved each other or it was a quick one-night stand in a bathroom somewhere in a nightclub in the 70s, you, by virtue of your breath, have every single right to be here. And if you can believe that in any way, then you can go about possibly with a certain fluidity and lack of tension in finding what your purpose is. And your purpose can change. It doesn't have to be one great thing. I think that many of us hold over our heads the idea that there is one philosopher's stone, that if we can find that, everything will be unlocked. And I don't know if that's true. But I think the purpose of a life can be marked day to day. It can be marked in a moment's relating with someone, or as we said earlier on, you know, that second of evolution that takes place in an epiphany, a personal epiphany, whatever it may be.
But I guess as I hear you talk about this, so many of these characters you played, and this is the difference between being an actor and making these choices versus these characters, are characters who in some way or another kind of surrendered will.
Mm-hmm.
They're waiting for the world to act on them rather than be active in that.
Right.
And that you found so many changes to ring on this state that these characters are. I just find it to be completely fascinating. I just wonder if it's as part of a religious background for you.
Or? Not really. I mean, I was raised Roman Catholic, and you know, and I was dragged to church every Sunday for the first, I don't know, 12 or 13 years of my life until I decided to go to church myself at 13 or 14 because that's where all the cute girls were. But organized religion doesn't really hold any stead in my life at the moment, you know.
But still, there's a conditioning that comes.
Yeah, there is the conditioning, but I kind of. You know, I would like to think that the conditioning was presented to me in such a kind of draconian fashion, where it was always accompanied by guilt more than hope, by, you know, sin more than faith, that it never turned me on. And it was something to kind of, only in a slipshod way, not aggressively, but kind of resist. So I don't feel like I'm resistant to the energies of faith or religion, nor do I feel like my work is imbued with what I grew up around with regards to Catholicism. Bobby Pellet in Horrible Bosses wasn't imbued with. Bullseye and Daredevil wasn't imbued with. That kind of thinking is not always welcome to the table. But if it's a character that I think, you know, is as open to my interpretation and is not just ruled by the mind and is not just ruled by behavior, is also governed by some emotional state of being, well then, you know, those ideas and those thoughts and feelings of mine, which, by the way, are all uncertainties, are all curiosities. And the best thing I can do by any character I play is imbue that character with certain curiosities and uncertainties, even if they're a high-ranking official of a governmental agency. There is always doubt that plagues every single man and woman on this planet, you know.
We'll take a break and step out of the confessional. My guest is Colin Farrell. We're talking about a number of things. It's a treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back. I'm wiping off the sweat. It's The Treatment. I'm talking to Colin Farrell. He's done a number of movies with a number of great directors. Most recently, of course, is The Lobster. And you just mentioned a couple of things I was going to get to, mentioning Bullseye and Daredevil and Bobby Pellet and Horrible Boss. So we could even go to Intermission. Well, these are also characters who have committed to a life.
Yeah.
But these are guys who actively cause trouble.
Yes, you know,
They're the devil on the shoulders compared to the person who's sitting there not doing anything.
Yeah. I mean, there's a certain I can't say it without judging myself, a certain superficiality to Bullseye and Daredevil and to Bobby Pellet and Horrible Bosses. That was just so much fun. I mean, you get to unburden yourself with the shackles of too much consideration in regards to backstory or the emotional movements of a character, or, you know, and
You do that? You divorce yourself from those in both cases?
Not divorce myself necessarily, but they were more about behaviours. Now, behaviours result, of course, as we know, from inner machinations, you know, whether it's the intellect or the emotional positioning of a person. But these characters were more about behaviours. They were more there to really inform the environment rather than inform the audience of what their personal journey was.
Well, again, even with intermission, I mean, we get to see this guy who seems like a charmer who punches somebody in the face
very quickly.
I mean, these are guys who are the flint to the fire. And so
they're catalysts, aren't they? And characters who are remorseless, you know, who are completely devoid of any compunction, you know, around their actions. And one of the interesting things, which I did a film, Fright Night, and it was a remake of the Chris
Darren. Yeah, exactly.
And there was about 2 weeks into it, I got really bored. And I never get bored in work. And I was kind of like, why am I? Because it's fun. It's a vampire. It's a trope of literature and cinema. And he has
no moral worry whatsoever.
And that was it. That's what bored me.
Really?
I realized, yeah, because, you know, somewhere inside Bobby Pellet, there's a broken child.
He wants people to like the nunchucks.
Absolutely.
He thinks he's a great guy.
Absolutely. He's completely broken. And he thinks he's a great guy, and he wants people to love him because he's got a big ego, but it's also smashed to 1,000 pieces. And he, you know, a father that never loved him, that he was a constant disappointment to, so he brings down the company. But you know, Daredevil was whatever he was, a sociopath. And Lahiff had his own upbringing. Lahiff was a very real character. I knew guys like Lahiff growing up.
Did you?
Intermission. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, guys that were just mental and violent and never even thought of breaking the law breaking anything. It was kind of a solidity, you know. It was maintaining, not breaking. It was maintaining some kind of discord and some kind of anarchy, not breaking anything. But then with the vampire, with Jerry and Friday Night, I realised, and all these characters have fear. All these characters, even Bullseye, you know, kind of he's turned on by, he's threatened by, but he also kind of fears and respects Daredevil in a little way. And, you know, Lahiff has a fear which he feeds off, even a fear he's going to get caught by the cops, which wouldn't have him cowering in the corner. It's a different fear, it's an adrenaline, but it's
also
a fear.
But he also feeds off the fear that he creates in others too.
Like, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Whereas Fright Night, the character had no fear, no kind of conscience at all, nothing that he loved. Nothing that he was afraid of losing, including his own life. And so I found that to be a weird kind of vacuum to inhabit, even though the film is a very light film. And I was like 2 weeks in, honest to God, Elvis, I thought, why am I bored of this? And I went, this character is not human. He's not an alien, but it's the first character I've played that is not human, that does not play the same virtues and restrictions and liberations that we can sometimes afford ourselves, and the fears and the hopes and love and desire, and none of those things.
It's funny because as you're saying this, Colin, you're saying that character lacked a soul.
Yeah.
And there's a soulfulness to all these characters you play.
Right. That was what it was, that he lacked a soul. And I was kind of like, wow, I found myself in a vacuum. And then I was fine. Then I enjoyed it. Then it freed me up to go, okay, that's cool. Now I'll just be camp. You know, I'll just enjoy the shit out of this as much as I can.
But so we're talking about remakes, and we should talk about, of course, your remake of an Arnold Schwarzenegger film you started. But that's another character in Purgatory. You know,
yeah.
Mars is a purgatory.
Very much so.
In that movie,
and
isn't
so it? Is not knowing who you are. You know, it's like Guy Pearce in Memento.
Yeah.
That's a purgatory.
That fear of that thing awakening.
Groundhog Day.
Yes.
Genius purgatory.
Yeah, completely, you know? That. And that also felt to me like, you know, what you were saying before about wanting to be engaged by the work, the idea of playing somebody, and Jerry's almost that kind of guy, this guy who, if you're just kind of going through the motions a little bit because your actions have no impact,
yeah.
I mean, if you can live forever and do whatever you want to do and you don't really have feeling for anything around you, you're basically encased in something. You're an amber.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that idea of playing somebody who couldn't engage because he didn't know what he was. I wonder if that was what attracted you to doing the movie.
To doing Fright Night?
Yeah.
I loved the original, which, you know, made me.
But that's a very campy term by Chris Sarandon. I mean, he basically.
So camp! And gorgeous. Like, loved it. I saw it for the first time when I was, and I used to love vampire films from, you know, whatever, Lost Boys, Joel Schumacher's, to Near Dark, which was genius. And but it was so camp by Chris, and I thought brilliant and fun. And so I didn't want to, you know, I was kind of, had I done Total Recall at that stage, or I don't know which came first?
So I was wondering, because it's the same actually kind of appends to Total Recall too. This is really somebody, and that's what I was wondering about too.
Yeah.
And doing that role, somebody who finally has to realize that he doesn't know who and what he is.
Mm-hmm.
If that was something that made you want to do that, because it's actually more spelled out in this Total Recall. I
mean, yeah, very much so.
He's really not an action figure here.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I thought I could. I mean, it did become, you know, the film that we made was, I think it was, it could have done with a few more dialogue scenes. You know, I think, you know, the studio was pushing for action, and they got it, but it was...
But the original story is really an existential crisis.
Absolutely.
As all Philip K. Dick is.
Philip K. Dick stuff is. Absolutely. And that's what I thought I could kind of angle myself in and toward, and have this character who was wondering who he was, and does the memories that visit us and haunt us, and how memory shifts and changes through the prism of the distance we have between that time we find ourselves in at the moment and when that memory was born. I mean, memories do shift and change. They're all basically about perspective, and perspective changes all the time. But are we the things we've been through, or do the things we've been through put us asleep to who we could become? And that's kind of what I thought I could kind of, you know, mine a little bit in Total Recall. I think I failed miserably, but I had a hell of a good time doing it. And, you know, that was about as physical a job as I've done. I mean, that was just, I must have spent 3 months with a harness and wires.
More so than Miami Vice, where you like bulked up and...
Well, yeah, because Miami Vice, the physicality was in the preparation. You know, I just did a slew of things, from lifting weights and some martial arts and shooting a pile of guns. But the actual practical experience of Miami Vice felt very much to me like a drama that had a couple of really big set pieces in it.
A really big set
piece. Like huge, you know, and I could get, that would justify you calling the whole film an action. But to me, it felt like, again, you know, a drama that had certain existential motifs. But
really? Because I thought your Sonny Crock is somebody who's always, you're always clenching your hands up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I thought
he was a man of dis-ease, you know. He was a man that would certainly present one aspect of himself, as so many of us do, but internally he was a man who wrestled with his own aloneness.
I didn't think that was internal for him, because I mean, he's so jacked up, kind of, that there's almost an anxiety. Again, this almost makes him, for me, one of these characters that we're talking about, this guy who refuses to acknowledge what he is and is causing that anxiety around him.
Right, right, right.
Finally, this brings me back to The Lobster a little bit,
yeah.
And you were talking about stillness, and what I found to be really remarkable, because I think of you as being a really physical actor, and again, I just liked the way you found a way to externalize Crock's extreme discomfort.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, he's just another boring action hero.
He's
not like constantly tensing up, almost looking for a fight, mm-hmm. so you can figure out that's
absolutely
what he knows how to do.
Yeah, yeah. It's great release of tension, man. Fighting is a great release of tension. There are other ways.
Which, by the way, he never really gets to do. I mean,
no.
He never really has that fist fight. Yeah.
He gets close.
Yeah, but
close.
It's the guns.
And then it's taken away in a boat.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And I wondered if that was one of the reasons you found yourself really attracted to The Lobster, because it's an incredibly still performance.
I didn't know I was going to be that still. I
really
didn't. No, the thing that attracted me to The Lobster was just the presence of a really saline, just pure kind of originality that was everywhere around the script. And I had seen Dogtooth, you know, Yorgos's previous film that he'd made 4 or 5 years before that, and I was astonished by
it. Which is another film about purgatory, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, Yorgos is someone who might suspicion that this whole human experience is purgatory, depending on how you look at it. But I read the script and I was confused by it. It exists outside of the conventional tropes of human experience. Something happens and there's not the conventional reaction, and that was on the page. So there are things that usually if you were imbuing The Lobster as a script and your character that you were playing with a naturalness, which at times is every actor's goal, you would have defeated the purpose. And so these characters were all, as you say, in this, I think it's a right use of the word, in this purgatory where, you know, there was very much living under the weight of a system that none of them comprehended, that they all just bought into. It was a very kind of patriarchal society where there was a particular set of rules in play. And yes, there were the anarchists, the loners, who were the outsiders, who had decided to live against the rule of law because they thought that unnatural. But then you find out that their world is possibly more horrific. You know, it's kind of saying revolutionaries are good at one thing. They're good at tearing things down, but they're not good at building them up. That's the purpose, you know, and there's a great place in that for every society around the world. But I had no idea I was going to be as still, or the delivery of the lines was going to be with as flat an effect as the lines had. None of us as actors got around. Yorgos didn't say, OK, I want you all to do nothing with the lines. Just say it as flat as you can. That was never spoken of. I think there was an understanding that Yorgos's work exists tonally in a particular place based on all the actors having seen Alps and having seen Dogtooth. But I also think maybe... I know I certainly believed that the worst thing you could do, his work is so specific that the worst thing you could do is commonalize it or negate the originality and the awkwardness of the characters within the story by trying to imbue them with a contemporary way of speaking, like you and I are speaking now, with a certain rhythm and a certain naturalness. That would just take it into a place that it didn't want to be. So the best thing you could do was just to honor the words on the page and be that kind of vacuum that allowed the audience to see every situation and every character within the situation as something of a cipher, you know? And the one rule I gave to myself doing The Lobster was listen like you've never listened before, because the character wasn't about affecting change. He really wasn't, you know?
Is that where that came from? Because it's one of the things that you can't help but notice about the film that really feels almost like a Harold Pinter version of a Philip K. Dick story.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
Idea of the pauses. And everybody pauses in that before they speak. I mean, nobody just reacts to anything.
Yeah.
Almost like this exaggerated politeness that's as much born out of awkwardness as it is a kind of civility that really is, comes out of fear.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's it. I think, you know, the characters are living in a greater deal of fear than they can recognize. I think there's a kind of a hesitancy and an uncertainty because the rule of law around them, while it's painted in such a kind of a mannered way, is very horrific. The idea of being turned into an animal, even if you do get to, like, the bonus is you get to choose the animal, but you still get turned into the animal and you're going to be some part of the food chain. It's very horrific. So I think all the characters are in this tension that they live in the whole time. I think my guy, the character I played, was so beautifully devoid of guile, so beautifully devoid of subtext. And there was such a great liberation that there was one thing. He didn't want to be alone. And I think, you know, John C. Reilly's character, Ben Whishaw's character, I think a lot of the other characters fear being turned into an animal. I don't think that David had that fear at all. I think his greatest fear, and I think that's why he is almost the most human of all the characters in the film, he's almost the most healed by being the most broken, because he's an irregularity. I think he's the most romantic character in the film, even though he's not quintessentially a romantic character. But he just doesn't want to be alone. He wants to have a partner.
But you realize, though, that by doing that and making this character kind of devoid of that subtextual ambition, that you're actually creating this weird tension because people are waiting for that to happen.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And also possibly creating a great sympathy as well, because there's fewer things as kind of moving to me as somebody who's in great pain and they don't realize they're in great pain. You know, and there's something about that. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's, you know, if somebody's in great pain and they recognize that you believe that they have maybe made the first step in finding their way out of that pain as a human being. But if somebody's in great pain and they don't realize it, and you know somebody's experiencing a deep, deep sadness and they're trying to be happy for the people around them, that's a crusher to me. So there's an element of that to David as well, which I found very moving.
See, and that gets me to, it's kind of my last question here, and I'm sorry to put you through all this, but I have one question left. But these characters almost all lack a kind of self-awareness that they're in pain. And that's, for me, kind of the emotional through line for some.
Syracuse didn't. Circus was aware of his pain, which is one of the things, again,
But he wasn't aware of the pain he was causing others, I think. I mean, this.
Well, no alcoholic is. It's part of the deal, man. It's not even in the small print. That's the headline.
But you see what I mean? There is a crucial lack of self-awareness at some point. Or let's say awareness.
Yeah.
In almost all these characters.
Yeah.
Do you like playing these characters who are that kind of misinformed about themselves?
Oh, man, I think we're all misinformed about ourselves. I think some of us are just better. Some of us are just better hiding it than others. Some of us are just better hiding it than others.
And on that note, we'll end it. But I'll ask you, please come back whenever you want. You're always welcome here.
Thanks, man.
My pleasure. My guest is Colin Farrell, who talked about any number of things, including The Lobster. Our recording engineer here at NPR West is Leo DeLagula. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. I know exactly who I am. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts.
The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.